North Pole Hotline.
Help! My in-laws are hosting Thanksgiving, and we're bringing the dressing.
You mean stuffing?
No, dressing. I need cute outfits for everyone.
Get to Old Navy.
Old Navy?
Yep, Old Navy's kicking off the holidays with stylish denim, velvet tops, the season's best dresses, and 40% off your entire purchase now through Tuesday.
40% off? We'll be stuffing our shopping bags full.
And don't forget colorful sweaters and amazing outerwear, too. You can even buy online and pick up in store for free.
Ooh, I love an all-you-can-wear buffet.
Holiday your heart out at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Valid 11/18 to 11/20. Exclusions apply. See stores for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. It is October 18th, and it is Horror Nights. And we have very special guests. We have Eric Sanza and DJ Vivona from Wicked Pixel. Hello, guys.
Hello, hello.
And we also have Tara, who will be co-hosting with me.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. Thank you for having us tonight.
Well, thank you for joining us. We're very excited. But I think we should just jump right on into this. So, guys, Eric, EJ.
Yes.
When did your interest in horror movies begin, and how did that lead you into making the horror films?
Well, the interest in horror, that goes back to when I was a very young lad. I was always interested in that sort of thing, but probably my teen years growing up in the Pittsburgh area brought it into focus, because that's where George Romero was making his Living Dead movies, and that was always sort of high on the radar in that area. So I was very aware of George Romero, and I was very aware of his movies, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead. And that just kind of got the gears rolling that I wanted to try to do the same thing.
And when did you make your first film? That was Savage Harvest, right?
Savage Harvest was, I think we shot that in 93. My memory is foggy, so I might struggle with some of these answers to these questions. 93, I believe, is when we shot that, and that was released in 94, 95, something like that.
Well, how did you shoot it? And with it being your first movie, what kind of processes did you learn as a director that you weren't expecting?
Well, actually, I learned something from every single shoot that I'm on. So just even as recently as wrapping our most recent feature, Ratline, I was learning new things on that project as well. So every project is a learning experience. But starting, you know, going back that far when I was very, very green, it was just an overwhelming amount of things basically avalanched on me, like, oh, I learned this. There's so many aspects of it, from scheduling a shoot to learning how to communicate better with actors to being, you know, more aware of where the financing dollars are going and trying to make friends up on screen and all that sort of thing. So basically, all across the board, I learned a lot about filmmaking from that early project, Savage Harvest.
And was there anyone to help mentor you while you were making this first movie?
Unfortunately, no. I guess that's been a good and a bad thing, that I very rarely had anybody around me that was more experienced than me. So the education was really great because I was making so many mistakes and learning from those mistakes, but obviously, the downside of that is I was making a whole lot of mistakes. So there really wasn't anybody like that around. And come to think of it, there hasn't been anybody like that around for the past 20 years. So I've been getting screwed, I think. I got to look into this, see if I can change some of this around.
You might. And again, if you make the mistakes on your own, you get to figure them out your own way rather than just using somebody else's methods.
That's true, and I value that quite a bit. A lot of people they ask me about the early learning experiences, and I do get down on my earlier projects because the skills were not as fine tuned back then, and I can see such a difference between the early projects and the recent projects, and I'm much more proud of the more recent projects. But I value the learning experience way too much to kind of, you know, wish I could go back in time and not make those mistakes.
Absolutely. Who knows where you'd be? But with that in mind, DJ. How did you get started in this with Eric?
Eric and I went to high school together, and I heard, this would have been way back now, back in 1988, I believe, I met Eric and heard through a friend of ours that he was doing a small little movie over the summer of 88, and I told him, you know, I'd love to get involved. I did some sound effects and wanted to do some acting, and he didn't have any acting parts at the time, but somebody dropped out. It actually was a female role, and he ended up changing it to a male role so I could be in it, and we made our first film together. It was called The Dreamin', and that was back in 1988, and though I know it makes Eric cringe to talk about those early student projects, but that is how we began. but that was the beginning. Some of the other things that I got when I started acting for Eric, you know, I did do some sound effects on the side for our early projects, but I always wanted to be an actor. I tried to get involved in every high school play that was available, and little by little just started to learn that I really enjoyed doing it, and I love movies, so I watch everybody, I watch everything I can, and sort of I love to put on a show. So acting for me with Eric has been a real treat, because Eric's allowed me to really hone in on my craft, so I'm very thankful that he wanted to direct and make movies for a living.
And what sort of actors or roles or movies really inspired you to want to be an actor?
I really don't have any particular, but I love the classics. I love all the original ones that came out during the late 70s, like Halloween and Escape from New York. I love John Carpenter films, at least the early ones. I really enjoy, you know, Star Wars and a lot of the Spielberg films like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I just love all of it. From an acting standpoint, I always want to be in the forefront as much as possible. I want the juicy roles where, you know, you can really be challenged by the role and people can see you perform. I love Christopher Walken and Gene Hackman, Jack Nicholson, you know, all the big names, Robert De Niro. From an independent standpoint, I loved Bruce Campbell in the Evil Dead films.
Absolutely.
I just love to act.
That's
go
great.
Ahead.
I said, that's great. I love Bruce Campbell myself, obviously.
I love to get wild and crazy like Bruce. Bruce is an inspiration.
He really is. I can totally see it. He inspires me to want to be an actor. I actually does inspire me to want to be an actress, because his type of movies are the ones I'd love to make.
Well, it looks like he has a lot of fun doing it, and the type of movies that he does, obviously, are fun movies to be in, even from the small roles that he's had in the Spider-Man films. You know, that's the thing about being an actor or being like Bruce Campbell in that way, is even if you have a small role in a project, I mean, you could really shine, you know, just in that small period of time that you're on screen. And I love that. As long as the role's good, I love to do that.
I agree completely. Okay, so then for a next one, how about Ice from the Sun? What was special about the opening credits for this film?
Well, I'm going to turn that over to Eric. That is a technical nightmare that's also a beautiful work of art. So, Eric, they want to know about the opening credits to Ice.
Wow, that was the idea was to jam as much imagery into this brief period of time with the opening credits, and that was a movie that I cut linearly, which is actually an older way of editing, and it's very tedious, and it doesn't give you a lot of room for making errors and then going back and fixing them. So you have to kind of plan everything out in advance and know exactly what you're doing, and not that kind of an opening credit sequence of how hyperactive it was isn't very easy to do, even when you have a nonlinear system where you're editing on a computer, but it's really difficult when you're editing linearly, which is the older system. So I just remember working on that opening credit sequence. That took many days to edit, and I was so focused in on the actual the cuts and adjusting them sometimes just a frame one way or another, and just, you know, scrutinizing every single edit, that it got to a point where I'd edit for maybe 10 or 15 hours, and then I'd go home and just try to relax and watch TV, and like a commercial would come on, and every edit that I saw on the TV screen would just, it was like a nail going into my brain. It hurt to see all of these edits because my brain was so fine-tuned and focused on the little quick cuts. But in the end, I was very happy with that, and it bears a similarity to the opening credits of the movie Seven, which I was very irritated by because Seven came out before Eyes from the Sun, but we actually completed our opening credits sequence before that movie came out. So it looks like I ripped them off. That's always bugged me.
I'm sorry. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very inventive. I didn't actually think of Seven when I saw it myself, but...
Oh, well, that's good to hear. I guess because Seven was, when it came out, we were being compared to it. So that's good that as time has gone on, people aren't still making the connection. So.
No, it was probably still very new, so mm-hmm. It was easier to nitpick on it. But DJ also pointed out that the soundtrack for that movie is available for purchase, and I really enjoyed it. So where can you get that?
Well, you can pick up the soundtrack for Eyes from the Sun, which is a very good soundtrack, at wickedpixel.com. That's our website. That's where you can get all the information about what we're doing now, all the information about what we've done in the past, and it's got a web store that sells not only the soundtracks, but the DVDs and, And Amazon iTunes. You can also pick it up there. Sorry, I'm getting signals from the sidelines here. If you go to wickedpixel.com, that you can not only get more information than you'd ever want to know about WickedPixel and what we're doing, but that's also where you can pick up that soundtrack and all of our other fine merchandise.
Indeed. I saw the T-shirts. And how are the T-shirts sized? I'm very curious on that one, and it was something I was, like, is it both sizes in general, or is it females, since it was a female model?
I don't know anything about the T-shirts. I have a very reliable individual named Jim Ware who handles all of our merchandise. And he's sitting right here, so I'm going to ask him, what's the deal with the shirts?
all the clearance ones are just random. Whatever size they're all
male. All right. In the clearance section, they're all male sizes, but... The horror merch T-shirts. There are female tank tops, as well as male T-shirts. There, I think I repeated everything Jim said accurately. So threw me off with that question.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
I have to ask, how many people are over there right now?
Let's see. It's me and DJ sitting here, and then Jim is sitting here, and Gus Stevenson just walked in. He's staring at me from the doorway to the room, so it's becoming quite the party over here.
Sounds fantastic.
There's more people in this room than maybe listening. I don't know. This is getting crazy.
I doubt that.
Now, you got a lot of people listening, don't you? This is a pretty popular show, yeah. Is it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, in the chat room alone, we have obviously more than you've got listed in that room. But then we also have a lot of people who are listening off.
I'm sorry, I've driven this way off track. I'll let you take the reins now and ask the proper question before I...
Oh, you're totally fine. I have a lot more fun when you're talking than when I'm talking. People like that are probably
sick of my
voice.
I don't know about that. But.
Oh, I guarantee it. All right, well then, if you want to move on, we can pass the phone to DJ for a second and ask him...
All right.
How they did his voice alterations for Eyes from the Sun, and how did you prepare for your role in this film?
Wow. Doing the presence for Eyes from the Sun was probably, it was challenging in the sense that my entire performance was very physical on set. literally knew that my lines were going to be re-recorded in a studio much later in post-production, in which case at that point we would knock the octaves out of my voice and give it a very otherworldly sound. So the challenge in preparation for doing the presence, literally I wanted to work out, give him a little bit more of a physical appearance, show that while he was on set, even though he didn't do a lot of hands-on with the victims in the movie, I still wanted him to look somewhat very physical, built somewhat, and let his costumes and stuff sort of highlight when he was on camera. I didn't want Eric and I had discussed a lot about, you know, subduing the character a little bit, not making him do a lot of talking, since a lot of what took place in the scenes, I had other characters interacting with the victims. But I remember a lot of nights shooting out in Macon, Missouri, on one of our major sets. Some of the things that I did is I meditated a lot, separate from the cast and the crew. I wanted the character really to be alone and be a sense of when he would come on set, I wanted the characters to feel that they were really up against something that didn't have to do a lot of talking, that didn't have a lot of action, but it was all in the look. It was all in the appearance. And I really tried to focus all my my facial expressions and everything. I wanted to be, I didn't want them to be over the top and very dramatic. I wanted them to really sort of have a psychological impact on the other actors by really just staring into their eyes very calmly, but with a tremendous amount of purpose behind those eyes. And I think it worked quite a bit. I met a lot of the actors for the first time in the actual scenes that we performed in, and I remember there being some nervousness in the other characters and the other actors, and that was great because I was able to feed off of that. So I did a lot of preparation just from a meditation standpoint.
I imagine you weren't very popular for a while there on set.
No, it's amazing. Some people are pretty funny around me, either from doing the movie or even approaching me during the film. it's always funny because, you know, here you're playing the main villain and you don't say a whole lot and you're in all these scenes and there's a lot of blood and guts that are going to come around, you know, in some of the scenes, and they know they're not going to fare very well. And so a lot of times I kind of get the cold shoulder, so to speak. But usually later we get some coffee and we talk about how things went down. And, you know, but I could always tell that somehow they've, hopefully they respect the fact that I'm acting and not that I live this way every day.
Well, I'm being asked, for anybody who hasn't seen the movie itself, can you guys give a bit of a recap on what your role in the movie is and what the movie is about?
With Ice from the Sun, essentially it's about the Dark Ages of the past, and there was a evil wizard named Amblin, and he had an apprentice, which is the character that I play, Abraham, and he creates a game in an alter dimension that he allows me to run inside the game. And every few years, we pull victims off the earth, usually in the cluster of six, and we sort of entrap them through a mysterious box that's presented to one of the characters. And little by little, we suck them into those dimensions so that I can play a sadistic game with all of them. And it's purely for entertainment for my character. Something goes horribly wrong, though, in Ice from the Sun at the beginning, and one of the characters actually, his name is Steven, he actually sort of defeats the game, defeats me, and even though I don't die, I end up in what's considered a purgatory. And in the process, I become very angry as this soul presence in this purgatory, and I break out and destroy that character, and then a new game begins. And I become the all-powerful presence where I've killed the main wizard. So now there's nobody else that has full dominion other than myself. The bad thing for the mythology of good and evil is that no no angel and no devil can have any other dominion with me being in my dimension. So what ends up happening is these characters systematically get killed off one by one inside my my game, so to speak. And the angels and devils unite to try to send in an assassin to reset the balance to the universe. And I, of course, my character eggs them on.
There you go, guys. That's Eyes from the Sun. And I have to say that that was a really good movie. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And your character was a little creepy.
Well, no, thank you very much. Well, I have to give a lot of thanks to Eric with that. We collaborated on the film, but Eric really wrote the real backstory to it, and even though it goes much further than we were able to execute on camera, we hope to one day maybe expand that that landscape to that film and maybe tell a little bit more about the history and show that this character really sort of lives on in the bigger concept of reincarnation, which is what the film's really about through choice.
We have a question from the chat room now that is, I suppose, in regards to people being freaked out by you on set. Is there any time that you have been freaked out doing a scene yourself, or does anything scare you when you're on set?
I think sometimes when I get so far deep inside of a role like The Presence, a lot of times because I'm such a spontaneous actor, I love being in the moment. And a lot of times I'll feel things and I'll see some opportunity when I'm acting with someone else that I'm even amazed sometimes by sort of how I will react to somebody in a scene and thrive off of, say, the misery of that character's demise. And it's sort of like I really start to feel like not only was I prepared to do this character, but somehow deep inside my psyche, I really sort of get so involved in it that I can literally see the fear in the other actor. And in a way, it's just, it's magic, and at the same time, it's a little creepy.
I can imagine.
But I wouldn't have it any other way.
Never. I mean, you have to have that sort of fear inside yourself and the other actors. It adds a lot more realism to the films, and therefore the audience themselves will feel that same fear.
Yeah, I love raw emotion, and I love other actors that can sort of get lost in the moment as well. And it takes a core group of people to really allow that to happen. I mean, you have, obviously, you have the magic of the crew, you know, getting everything set. You've got Eric's direction and his attention to detail. But when it comes right down to that moment and it's actor to actor, I love that exchange because it's like the whole world stops and you're just able to live those characters to the degree that you want to bring it on in front of the camera. And hopefully it translates later on screen and people can just go nuts with it. And that's the beauty of working with Eric and the crew that we have is we've always found those moments within our films where we can just unleash what we're really good at. And I'm just very thankful that I get to work with such a talented group of people.
I'm sorry. I'm getting very...
Bring it on. Come on, all you chatters. Bring it on. Let's hear them.
Oh, they are.
We're just getting started.
Watch the chat room and all that good stuff. So I'm going to jump in and kind of help Courtney watch the chat room so she can get to her questions, and then I'll read the chat room questions off. And Tara, you can do the same thing, and we'll help Courtney out here.
What she's trying to say is Courtney keeps getting distracted, and she's going to keep me in line.
Exactly.
Well, we will patiently wait for that next grand question.
Well, then this one's going to be a really good one. Are you guys ready for this?
We're ready. Into
your seat? Fantastic. All right, China White Serpentine. This movie is quite a bit different than Savage Harvest and Ice from the Sun, in both the content and the way it was filmed. Can you guys tell us a bit about what that movie was about and how it got started?
I'm going to let Eric take that over, and then I'll chime in as necessary.
Fantastic.
All right. China White's Turpentine. That actually is a project that is not a Wicked Pixel Cinema production. We were hired to make that movie for other producers out of New York and the UK and France. And it was a project that evolved quite a bit from the early spark of the idea up until when we were actually shooting it. And it was something where my schedule was absolutely, it's always insane, but it was even more insane at that time, and it was on again, off again as to whether or not I was going to be a director on that project. And eventually it just came down to both me and this girl, Robin Garrels, also a very talented writer-director, kind of bit tag-team directing on the movie. Because neither of us had the time to direct it, but both of us really liked the project and wanted to do it, so we just kind of shared the experience there. And it was something where at the early stages it was much more abstract, and we were interested in going even more, I guess, Lynchian, where we were going to present a lot of concepts and imagery and not really bother to explain it and just sort of let it be out there open to interpretation, and have less of a solid narrative backing it up. And it just evolved the progress of the script just draft to draft. We kind of latched onto a story that we liked and let that sort of rise to the surface. So it's almost like two stories at the same time. It's this love story between these two junkies that are trying desperately to get out of the situation that they're in. And then it's the story that is about DJ's character, who's trying to find his brother, who he thought had passed away, but now maybe he hasn't passed away. His brother being one of these junkies that's desperate to escape his dismal situation. And a lot of the movie was, I think the energy that the movie has came out of the fact that we had exactly 1 month to start and finish shooting. And I remember it was the month of August, and so we had basically from the first day of August to the last day of August, and that's all we got. And we had to kind of scramble everybody's schedules together and make it work, and it was very, very fast shooting and kind of a blur now looking back on it. But I think that for that project, that was the right kind of schedule to be working on, because it did give the movie a unique energy. And we've worked for this company in New York a few times, and this is, China White's probably the only project that I worked on for them that I'm actually still really proud of. I like China White Serpentine, and I think it's got a very unique vibe to it. And, of course, all the actors, including DJ, really very impressive that they were able to do what they did in such a very rushed shoot.
Sorry, I'm over here. Go ahead, Courtney.
Go ahead, Amy. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to, I'm over here on your website, and I'm watching, I have to watch it with the sound off because we're on air, but I'm watching some of the videos, and what I'm seeing is horror movies that scare the crap out of me, and that's what I love. The new movies, like the Halloween movies that are coming out now, they don't scare me. They make me laugh sometimes, but I'm watching these clips and I'm like, no, I'm not going to be able to watch that until like the sun rises.
Well, that's a positive thing. I'll take that.
We'll do group viewings.
There you go.
Exactly. Not watching by myself.
Just have somebody there with you to hold your hand. You'll be fine.
I'm going to have to do, but I'm definitely going to check, because I haven't watched any of your movies, so I'm definitely going to check it out.
Well, we appreciate it.
I've been living under a rock, I guess.
Yes, you have.
Yeah, what's the matter with you? That's crazy.
I have no idea.
Just tell yourself over and over, it's just a movie. It's just a movie.
Yeah, you'll be
Wait
fine.
Wait a second.
Then I see my neighbor.
All right. So then I guess going on for a different approach, once again, let's move on to Deadwood Park, which is probably the most unique in terms of how the film was shot and the cinematography of the film. So what kind of changes did you make to your normal filming techniques that set this film apart?
Well, first and foremost, we had done a lot of very quick shoots for other companies around the world, and I was really sick of being put into that position of having very little money and not enough time, and people being very demanding of the deadline and not very demanding of the quality of the movie, and that had really worn me down and really bothered me, and I didn't want to work for those people anymore. And so Deadwood Park was the first project where I went back to, all right, Wicked Pixel Cinema is going to produce this. We're going to make this, you know, in-house and do this entirely on our own. And the first decision that I made was, this is going to be a big movie, and we're going to take our time with it. I'm going to dig myself into a very deep hole and then spend this entire production trying to claw my way out of it. And I really just wanted to make a more epic movie that I would be able to spend that time on and really, you know, think about on a bunch of different levels and fine-tune and just have the time to make it something I could be proud of. So that was the biggest change, was giving myself a lot of time to make the movie. And then another approach was, you know, we'd done Scrapbook, and we had done Ice from the Sun, and we'd, you know, started off with Savage Harvest, and these were, you know, different. These movies were all different from each other, and I just wanted to do something else that wasn't like what I'd done before. And I'm a big fan of Mario Bava films, and he had made all these movies in the 60s and 70s that were very sort of gothic and creepy and had a lot of just atmosphere that was kind of dripping with dread, and I'm a big fan of that kind of movie, and I wanted to take a stab at doing something like that myself. So I decided it had to be an epic story and something that we'd have to spend some time on, and I wanted it to be very visually driven and be have a lot of atmosphere to it and kind of play off like a classic ghost story or a classic horror movie. Ice from the Sun was, that was just insanity in that movie, and then Scrapbook was kind of in the rape revenge genre, and Savage Harvest was kind of a fun, over-the-top B-horror movie, you know, possession flick full of fun gore and action, and I just wanted Deadwood Park to be completely different from all of those movies.
Well, it really was. It was probably my favorite of the ones I'd seen. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about the movie in context of plot and storyline?
Sure. The movie actually spans several decades, and it's about this small Midwestern town that had a very successful amusement park at the edge of town, and that was sort of the, I guess, the economic hub of the town. So the town did very, very well because all these people came to enjoy the amusement park. And then at a certain point in time, children started going missing from this town, and their bodies were being discovered on the amusement park property. And once this very nasty publicity started to get around, attendance to the park plummeted, and the park eventually shut down and plunged this Midwestern community into just poverty, and it strangled the town economically. So you're kind of dealing, it's a movie about two things. It's a movie about this mystery of, you're looking at this cast of characters, and you spend a portion of the movie trying to figure out who was the child murderer, who was actually responsible for all of these terrible deeds. And then the other part of it is seeing how the small town continues on after this economic strangling, and how does the sort of dread that hangs over the town from all these children being murdered, how does that impact the disposition of this community as well?
Well, I picked up a lot on the economic. I can really see that, because it's kind of a lot of things that are happening right now in town, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of things shutting down, and so that did stick out a lot to me. Another thing that did is the scenery of the film. I really love the scenery and how you went back and forth between the times of, you know, the mm-hmm. World War II times, and then the, I believe it was the 60s, wasn't it? 60s, 70s? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it's a movie that essentially starts in 1943 and then progresses up to present time. So that was one of those challenges that I kind of liked putting in front of me and in front of my team was, you know, with a very limited independent budget, can we pull off these period sequences and try to nail, you know, make you believe that you're actually seeing something that's taking place in 1943 or 1979, and that was part of the tremendous challenge and part of the fun of making that movie.
I think you did it very well. I mean, there were certain points where I was actually looking at it like I was seeing it, you know, in a theater, a big budget film, especially when it came to the sequences with the Dogwood Park, where you had the actual amusement park in its heyday, and then you were going back to present times where it was broken down. How did you do that? Was that amusement park already there, or did you guys actually build that?
That ended up representing maybe the biggest production challenge on the shoot. We had scouted an amusement park in North Carolina, because we went all over the country looking for amusement parks that we could shoot those sequences in. We needed a closed down, preferably, you know, rather dilapidated amusement park to shoot all of our modern day sequences of this old park. And we just sort of combed the entire country looking for an amusement park that we could use. And we found one in North Carolina, and it was called Ghost Town in the Sky. And it was this big amusement park that was built essentially on the top of a mountain. And we talked to the owners and told them what we were trying to do, and everything was, you know, set. Everybody was happy about the situation, and we had a certain number of days, I think 2 weeks blocked off, maybe it was a week and a half, but a sizable amount of time that we were going to be, the entire cast and crew would be in North Carolina living at this park and shooting all of our park scenes. And about 48 hours before we were to leave to go and begin this week and a half, 2 weeks of shooting in North Carolina, the location manager in North Carolina called us and said, stop, do not come out here. The amusement park has been destroyed. And it was a hurricane that hit the East Coast, and it essentially just demolished this park that we were going to be shooting in. And it was worse that it was up on the top of a mountain, essentially, because as the hurricane hit it, just huge portions of this amusement park literally slid down the mountain. And not only did we not have a location, but we couldn't even go out there to try to scrounge footage because it was dangerous and it was just not safe for us to go out there. So we had the challenge of trying to stay on schedule, and while we're shooting other scenes of the movie, go back to square one and start scouring the country for a new amusement park. And that we got it in just in time because we had to shoot the amusement park before winter came and snow fell on it. And Jeremy Wallace, the producer, he was able to find this old amusement park in Ohio thanks to some help from the Ohio Film Commission. And we were able to go out there and shoot probably 80% of our closed down park sequences. It was actually what you see in the movie, the old amusement park in the movie, is actually a combination of two amusement parks that we shot in, and one was the one that he found in Ohio, and one was Dog Patch USA down in Arkansas.
Yeah, Ghost Town, that hurricane really tore up Ghost Town, because I'm in North Carolina, but it's up and running now. They closed down a couple years ago, but they're open back up with new owners and stuff, so next time you need to film an amusement park, there you go.
That's very good to hear. Actually, I know that when we scouted it and got the go-ahead to shoot there, they were trying to sell it. So that's good to hear that they were actually able to find new buyers, and the buyers were able to get it up and running again. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm actually going there next weekend.
Really? That's very odd.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, there you have it.
Eric, this is Tara. I have a couple questions for you.
Hello, first question is,
to date, what is the most critically acclaimed film that you've made?
That's probably Scrapbook. And I think that the reason why is there are a lot of movies that come out that are kind of in that subject matter. It's in the sort of rape revenge subcategory that kind of found its footing in the 70s, but that kind of brutal subject matter continues to be explored by filmmakers today. And I think most of the time that subgenre is employed solely for shock value. And a lot of filmmakers think, well, if I do the subcategory of the rape revenge horror film, you know, it's going to have sexual violence in it, it's going to have nudity, and it's therefore going to be shocking, and therefore it will sell. And I think why Scrapbook kind of pushed some of the other movies of similar content out of the limelight and stole some of that limelight is because we went into it with just a different attitude. I mean, we didn't go into it thinking we're going to make money with this movie. We actually went into it thinking, well, nobody's going to want to see this. There was a point on the first day of shooting where I looked at the cast and crew, and we actually had just finished shooting a rape scene that happens early in the movie. And I looked at the cast and crew, and I said, you know, 10 people are going to see this thing, and then it's going to vanish off the face of the earth. Is everybody comfortable still going ahead and shooting the rest of this movie? And everybody was very, you know, it was unanimous, and everyone enthusiastically said, yes, we should finish this movie. Let's do it. And I think the different attitude that I had was, well, we're going to show all of that stuff. We're not going to shy away from the violence. We're not going to shy away from the sexual violence. In fact, to be as respectful as possible to the subject matter, we're going to make this as ugly as possible and use every kind of trick in the filmmaker's toolkit to show the emotional damage that is going on as well as the physical damage. And that, I think, then gives a lot more power to the character of Clara, played by Emily Hack, who's the victim in this movie, when the gears start turning in her head and she starts figuring out how to escape, how to overcome her, you know, the guy that has captured her and done all these horrible things to her. And I went into it just thinking, well, this is the most accurate and respectful way to handle the material, is to make it as brutal and honest as possible. And I think just because we paid attention to those levels and, I guess, achieved some success in trying to make the movie function at those levels, that's why it got the rather positive reviews that it got.
I definitely saw a lot of reviews where the critics were saying that it was extremely realistic. What did the fans think of it, though? I mean, did they appreciate it being as, you know, like you said, brutal as it was, or would they have preferred to have had something a little more sugar-coated?
What the most common response that I heard from people about the movie, sometimes this was from critics, but most of the time this was from just horror fans or independent film fans. The thing that I heard the most was, hey, Scrapbook is a great movie. I never want to see it again. And that, to me, I guess, is about the most desirable response I would like to have for that movie, is that we did the best job that we could, and it impacted people, and it has emotional resonance, and that, you know, we achieved our goals. But it's a movie about a woman being captured and brutalized and raped. So if you do your job right, you're not going to want to see it again. You're going to be horrified by it. You're going to be depressed at the end of it, or so shocked by it that it's not going to be something you want to, you know, you're not going to want to pop popcorn and invite grandma over and watch it every few months. This is going to be an ugly movie if you do it right. So that kind of response is the most common one that I heard, and I'm happy to have that response to the movie out there.
I think that's one of the hallmarks of a truly great movie, something that really makes you look at a subject matter and really think about it instead of just leaving the theater and going, oh, well, that was nice, but whatever. Whenever you're writing your screenplays, whenever you're thinking what your next project will be, do you focus more on what you would like to do as a director, or do you really stop to consider what your audience may want to see next?
Because I am a horror fan as well as a horror filmmaker, it's inevitable that I'm going to consider the audience, because I'm part of that group. So I'm. It was interesting when I started attending a lot of these horror movie conventions, and now when I'm at a horror convention, I'm typically listed as a guest, and I'm behind a table, and I'm autographing DVDs and all that kind of stuff. But I remember going to the conventions before that sort of thing started, and I remember having it in my head that I just really need to enjoy this and just be out here as a fan and just, you know, not be the filmmaker, not be a guy trying to get his next movie financed or whatever, to just be out here as a fan and soak it up and have fun, because I just consider myself part of that community of fans. So it all kind of blurs together. I do consider what the fan base would be interested in, but it's mostly because I'm part of that fan base, and it's certainly not a situation where I'm thinking, oh, how can I score a quick dollar off this fan base? If I put this ingredient into this movie and this ingredient into this movie, then they'll buy it and I'll have their money. I certainly have never thought of it in those terms. I think about what would interest me when I'm making the movie, and then I'm also thinking about, you know, would I want to watch this as a fan when it's all complete and out there.
And, well, let me ask you. You mentioned earlier that budget is always a concern for the independent filmmaker. If this was not a concern for you, what kind of movie would you like to make, and what actors would you like to see involved in your project?
Well, the top actor that I'd like to see is DJ Vivona, because he's sitting in the room with me right now. No, he actually, if I'm getting paid to make a movie, my first and foremost thought is, well, what are they paying me to make? And I'm going to make, I consider myself a filmmaker who can, you know, pursue a project that I'm passionate about and make something that is, you know, right for my soul. But I also consider myself a professional who can be hired to do a job better than somebody else that they might hire to do that job. So if the budget's coming to me and they're hiring me to make the most, you know, brutal, gory, shocking horror movie that I can make, well, that's what I'm going to make. And then if they're paying me to make, you know, something about, you know, a fuzzy puppy that befriends a cute little duck, then I'm going to make the best damn fuzzy puppy duck buddy movie that you've ever seen. So,
and the little duck turns on the little fuzzy puppy and starts eating it?
Well, I'm thinking the other way around, but I'll consider your notes on that screenplay.
Okay.
And DJ says he wants to play the duck, so.
Well, you also mentioned the various conventions and stuff that you've gone to, and I know you were at a sci-fi one in Tulsa, Oklahoma recently.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Correct. That was one where it was kind of a last-minute addition to the show. Normally we go down there with a whole crew, and we've got a big table set up, and, you know, you can buy all of our DVDs and all, like, the whole boat goes down there. But at the Tulsa convention, I was kind of like a last-minute addition to the thing. There were some scheduling problems going into it, and I didn't even know until a week before the convention if I'd be able to attend. But that was fun because I ended up going down there and just to participate on a Q&A panel about screenplay writing, and it was specifically screenplay writing for independent films. And it was not only interesting to see how many people were interested in that sort of thing, but hear what the questions these people were asking, and I don't know, it's always interesting to be in that position and have fans ask questions, is because you gain a little bit of insight as to, you know, what interests them and what things would they like to know more about, and it always ends up being as educational for me as it is for them, I think.
Yeah, that was another question that I had about these conventions, is how interactive, you know, are the fans with you? I mean, do they sit there and go, oh, well, you know, I watched Eyes from the Sun and you could have done this part so much better, or, you know, I watched Deadwood Park and this part was just awesome. You've got to keep doing that in your next movies. How interactive are they with you?
That about describes it. I mean, they don't feel any kind of generally they're very polite, and they do come up and they say mostly positive things. Very rarely does some guy come up to the table and say, you know, that scene in Savage Harvest, that sucked. You shouldn't do that anymore. That doesn't happen very often. Usually they're very polite and respectful and whatnot. But, you know, you can engage in real conversations with them as well. And every once in a while they'll point out something that they did or that they maybe didn't like as much as they'll point out something that they did like. And I always find that feedback very valuable. Typically, if it's somebody who's upset about something, like, oh, that one scene in that one movie, I didn't like that, typically that's a lesson that I've already learned. Probably, you know, a year before that fan said that to me, I probably sat there and said, wow, I could have done better on that scene. But still, it's nice to hear that feedback, mostly because it's just people coming up and saying, hey, I saw your movie, and I remembered it, and I remembered you. And, you know, when we don't have a $20 million marketing budget behind every movie, it's always great to have people come up and say that they're even, you know, interested in what you're doing. So.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you.
So you have a new movie coming out called Ragline. Can you tell us a little bit about that one, and have you tried anything new with this one?
Trying things new is kind of the trying new things for this movie is the focus, I think, of what we wanted to go into with Ratline. I like doing things very different on each movie, and Ratline was a movie that kind of followed on the heels of a couple of other projects that we tried to get financed, and those projects fell apart when we lost the financing for these bigger movies, and Ratline was put into production because it was smaller. And it was almost like a plan B or a plan C type project after not being able to gather the funding for these bigger movies. And there was an attitude. I wrote it with a guy named Jason Christ, who also acts in the movie, and a very good writing collaborator. And some, I think kind of an attitude that we had going into Ratline was, well, you know, nobody was giving us the money for these bigger movies, and we can do whatever the hell we want with Ratline, and we just kind of let our imaginations go wild, and that was a blast. And it doesn't really fit into typical horror movie cookie-cutter shape. It's a very, the thing I'm most excited about with Ratline is it's just a really unique story, and I think that it could stand out, you know, whenever it gets released. If it was released 10 years ago, I think it would stand out because I'm that enthusiastic about the story. But today you look around, everything's a sequel or a remake, and I think that it's really going to stand out today because it's not that at all. It's not a sequel, it's not a remake, and it's completely, I think, fresh, and I think I hope it will be viewed as a kind of a shot of adrenaline for the horror crowd out there. I like the fact that you're not going to know what's going to happen around every corner of the plot. And I'm very excited about that aspect of the movie. So it's nothing like any of my other projects, and hopefully it's not going to be seen as anything like anything else that's out in theaters now or available on DVD now. I hope that it will be embraced as something really unique.
I completely agree. I imagine the Asians are getting quite a bit of a laugh at how many of their movies have been popping up over here.
yeah, laughing all the way to the bank.
Exactly, right? Especially the ones mm-hmm. who got to do the original and then are like, get to come over here and do the remake, and they're making twice as much money for the exact same idea.
Yeah, I've got a lot to learn. I need to get in on these scams. Somebody
you really should.
This is lucrative for somebody, but not me.
So what is Ratline about that? And you're so excited about it. What is it?
Well, part that's weird. It's like the part that I'm excited about is the part that makes it difficult to describe. I'll give you the starting point premise of it. The beginning of the story is about in Nazi SS scientists and under the employment of Heinrich Himmler, who were engaged in paranormal research. And there are these three scientists that were essentially in the late 30s, early 40s, attempting to find paranormal avenues to win the war. And these three scientists were, through these experiments, they were exposed to various dark supernatural forces. And then the end of the war came, and one of the scientists was able to flee and escape before being tried for war crimes. Well, these scientists, having been exposed to these supernatural forces, they don't age. They stopped aging, and in fact have they can heal from their wounds very quickly, and they've almost attained this sort of this supernatural resilience. And so this one scientist that escaped, he's able to continue eluding his the people that are trying to hunt him down, because every year that goes by, he stays the same age, but they're looking for an older man. Obviously, right now they'd be looking for, you know, a very elderly man, and this guy's walking around looking 30 still. So the movie, it starts with that, but this Nazi scientist, this ex-Nazi scientist, he's been operating on the assumption that he's immortal and he's got all the time in the world and he can do whatever he wants and take his time with it. And even though he has an interest in sort of reopening that supernatural floodgate and pushing forward the same ideals that the Nazis had, he's kind of been waiting for the right time. And in our story, he learns that he is not immortal, that he has the same lifespan as anyone else, even though he isn't aging, even though he heals from his wounds very quickly. He could die in 4 years, he could die in 4 hours. So the interesting thing about Ratline is watching a bad guy who is not just hell-bent on achieving some evil goal. It's fun to watch a bad guy who is kind of freaked out at the fact that he may, all of a sudden he realizes, well, I may not have time to reach these goals. I may not have time to do my evil deeds because I could die of old age at any time. And I think that that's a kind of a unique layer to add to a bad guy in a horror movie.
Absolutely. That sounds really interesting. And you said that when it gets released, is there not an official release date for it yet? And if there is there a premiere?
We're somewhere in the middle portion of post-production, so we definitely don't have a release date set yet. And in fact, we're still evaluating our distribution options. We've got people interested in the movie, but we're still sort of wanting to investigate all options. So basically all of it's up in the air right now, and we don't know exactly when it will be completed, and we don't know who will release it yet either. So that's another one of those things where if you're interested in the project, you can always keep checking back at wikipixel.com, because as soon as we have any news, including a release date, we'll absolutely post it there and everywhere else.
And Eric also has a Twitter account, so if you follow Eric_Stanze, STANZE, he'll also give you information periodically on his Twitter.
Absolutely. I'm trying to use the Twitter right now mostly to keep people, if you're interested in the progression of Ratline through post-production, you can follow me on Twitter, and every once in a while I'll throw out an update as to what's happening there. And we've also got one of the things that's kind of like keeping post-production, it's going fast and slow at times, because the production budget we were trying to raise during the movie, we were able to raise most of it, but not all of it. And we've been still raising. It's really difficult right now to get financing for a movie. Even the Hollywood studios are slowing down production, so you can imagine how difficult it is for an independent movie to get its financing. And that's one of the things that's making post-production kind of start and stop, and it goes fast, and then it goes slow, and then it goes fast again, and then it has to slow down again, and that's all dependent on the money coming in to complete the movie. So one of the things that we did set up is on, again, at wikipixel.com, there's a banner there where you can go check out how to get your name in the credits of Ratline, and if that at all intrigues anybody, definitely go to wikipixel.com and click on that banner, because that's one of the ways that we're keeping the trickle of income coming in to keep post-production going.
And seeing that I've been living under a rock, where can I purchase your movies?
Again, wikipixel.com. All of our titles are available on the web store at wikipixel.com. But there's also, you can get them on Amazon.com and most of the most of the bigger retail online stores. Like, is it on BestBuy.com? And Netflix has most or all of our stuff. So all the usual places that you would pick up a flick online, you can find our stuff.
Awesome. So who's coming over tonight to watch Netflix with me? Anybody?
Tara and I are all the way up here, so you can drive up here and have a viewing party with us.
Okay, I'll do that.
Fantastic. All right, so we have a few more fan questions, and then we may do a little bit of a closer. What is the scariest or favorite character that you have done, DJ?
Well, I think everybody's going to be in for a treat with Ratline. Eric really opened up the floodgates for me to be a new villain, a new kind of villain in the film, and which is far different than playing the presence in Ice from the Sun. This character, in contrast, is much dirtier, much more methodical, more hands-on, and essentially he's a real bad guy. And Eric really offered me the role to really sort of, at first it was kind of like, hey, I want you to play another villain. And I was like, oh, no, not another villain. And he says, but wait a second. I want you to, I really want you to get your hands dirty. I want you to really unleash your acting chops and really sort of bring a new kind of performance to playing a villain. And at that point, I was excited because I didn't necessarily want to play another villain, but when I read what he had and we discussed the role, I said, no, that's definitely the next thing to do. And I think people would be pretty excited with my performance. I got to ad-lib a little bit and had a lot of physical acting going on with some of the actors in the scene. For the first time, I was able to work with Emily Hack, and I got to work with Jason Christ again. And we have a very interesting scene in the film that I think people are going to go, wow. It's a lot of action, and there's some real physical contact. And I had a lot of fun doing it and getting involved in it. So I think Ratline to date is probably my favorite performance that I've done, and I was very thankful that Eric did bring me another villain to play.
Well, I'm very excited to see that movie, and I'm sure Tara and I will be having a movie party at her house. Yes, I volunteered your place.
Everyone's invited. Everybody knows.
She makes excellent food.
That she does. I've actually sampled some of that.
Indeed. Indeed. We need to do a repeat performance.
Anytime. Just let me know.
Sounds good. I'm hungry.
That will be on DJ and Eric to let us know. All right. Well, is there anything that you two would like to discuss that I have failed to bring up? Perhaps illegally breeding pandas. Any ideas on that?
That's not supposed to be public.
No comment, right?
Yeah, no comment. I'm just leading the fest on that one. Hey, we got to get that budget money coming in somehow.
I couldn't resist. I saw that and went, wait a second, what?
I actually forgot all about that, so it took me like 2 seconds when you said that. I'm like, what the hell are they talking about? But now I get it. So,
in case anybody else would like to know what I'm talking about, you should follow Eric on Twitter at ERIC_STANZE, and then you too can follow them and their illegal breeding of panda bears. Or you can just help them out and go on their website and donate so that they can, you know, not get arrested.
Yeah, we're thankful for every dollar or panda that we receive. So, give generously.
And all their links will be up on our website, and I'm going to actually keep their link up here on the Blog Talk Radio bar, right underneath ours and Vampire Wine. So, you guys are going to stay on our website.
We appreciate that.
Enjoy. Thank you guys so much for coming on. It was a lot of fun. Very informative.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate the support very much, and it was very nice talking to you.
And if you ever want to pop back on when your movie comes out, let us know. We'll be glad to have you back.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Definitely. Thank you very much, and thanks for purchasing our films out there and watching them, and we really greatly appreciate being on Vamp Radio.
Amy, do you want to do it?
Well, you guys have a great night, and I can't wait to see you in your movies.
Awesome. Thank you. You too.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye. Good night. Courtney, you did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
That you did.
Tara, thank you. Amy, thank you for popping on and helping me out.
You're welcome. So, schedule for this week. We do not have a True Blood show. We probably won't have a True Blood show until, I'm going to say November, because October is like a really bad time for everybody because we're all busy because it's our favorite month. Because Halloween and my birthday.
Yay!
And then
Memphis
Tuesday,
for Halloween!
Yay! And Tuesday we'll have Twilight Diaries. And Wednesday, Wednesday we're not going to have a band night. Thursday we're going to have Bloodbath and Books, where Marcus, Kelsey, and hopefully Ashley will be talking about childhood books, your favorite childhood books. Seeing that some of our favorite childhood books are coming to the big screen now with Where the Wild Things Are and what's the cartoon that just came out? The Meatballs and Raining and the one
where
the
yes, Cloudy and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yeah. So they're going to be discussing that, and I believe, but I'm not sure, on Friday's flashback, we are going to discuss music videos because you really don't get to see, you know, music videos a lot anymore on TV. We're going to go back where it was nothing but MTV music videos all day, 24 hours.
Beautiful.
You know, I am probably the only person ever who got grounded for watching too much MTV.
Yeah,
I bet
you probably
you are.
MTV for my generation was nothing but reality shows. And my brain
yeah.
was rotted.
Yeah, well, I'm old school. They actually played music when I watched it.
See, and I got like both. I got the music, and then all of a sudden it was nothing but reality shows, and I missed the music.
Yeah, I was the TRL generation. That was mine. That was the best music. I used to wake up and I'd watch VH1 or I'd watch MTV and I'd get some music videos. But when I was a late teen, that's when they really started shifting to reality shows. Now you'll be lucky if you actually do see anything music related on their channel anymore.
Yeah, you have to be like up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly.
See that. So that's probably what we're going to do on Friday, and then Saturday we'll be back with Twilight. Or Twi Talk AM, and then Dreamers Radio. And then that's our schedule for this week. And then we have some guests coming up. Next week we have Brian Leaf, who wrote Defining Twilight and Defining Moonlight. So definitely check out that interview. And I think that's all the news I have. Oh, happy birthday, Trevor Munson. It's his birthday, and they told me to say it on air, so happy birthday, Trevor.
Happy birthday, Trevor. Anybody who doesn't know who's in our chat room, Trevor Munson wrote Moonlight. Yay.
Yes, creator and writer of Moonlight, and he wrote the movie Lone Star State of Mind with Joshua Jackson. And if you want, check out our message board. We're going to have, like, videos for Trevor that we're going to put together and tell him happy birthday and how much we love him and all that good stuff. So I'll post that sometime next week. Busy. But that's about it.
Great. Well, thank you again, everybody, for joining us. And thank you, Eric. Thank you, DJ. It was fun. I am saying adios.
I enjoyed listening.
Courtney signing out. Yeah, me too. especially as I said with Deadwood Park, and I'm watching it and I'm seeing the scenery and I'm going, man, this is fantastic. I want to go play in
I really hate that they couldn't film in Ghost Town. That, oh my gosh, the Red Devil roller coaster is awesome. It like goes over the mountain.
Oh really?
Oh yeah, it goes off the mountain. It's scary.
Tara would.
We may have to come see you. I love roller coasters.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
you would
love
them.
I hate them.
Oh, you would love this one, Terry. It goes off the mountain.
I probably would. Well, Courtney knows what I'm like at a carnival. You know, the more extreme the ride, the more I laugh.
Yeah, we were on this ride together, and I had my eyes shut, and I was, like, falling out of my seat, freaking out. But I was doing it quietly. I had my dignity. I had my eyes shut, and I was just gripping the bars like I was going to die. And she's like, are you okay? I said, I'm about as far from okay as we could get. She's cackling. Her hair is flying around her face, and she's loving every second of it. And I'm just like...
No, it's when it rides that you actually lift up out of your seat. The G-force, you know, is so extreme. You know, and the only thing holding you in your seat is the roll bar.
Yeah.
That's a ride.
And you're upside down practically, by the way, too.
Practically, yeah.
Okay, Terry, you're going to have to come. Next summer, you're going to have to come out here because Carowinds is building a new roller coaster, and they're saying it's bigger than anything that you've ever seen and faster than anything you've ever seen.
Oh, that sounds good.
So we'll have to make a trip and get you both down here, and me and Courtney will hang on to each other while you're over there cackling and hair blowing in the wind.
It's a steel coaster, not a wood coaster, right?
I'm not sure.
Because you just can't get the speed on the wood coasters. It has to be a steel.
I'm pretty sure it's steel. I think they only have one wooden roller coaster there, so I'm guessing that they're going to go with steel this time. They have two. The one that goes backwards, Days of Thunder. That's a scary one, too. I hate roller coasters. I'm getting terrified just talking about it.
Yeah, no.
Okay,
Tara.
And another thing, you girls were talking over here in the our little private chat that you have another show. You want to tell our listeners about that?
Well, we have on Dreamers Radio, you could say sister station of Vamp Radio, we have Dreamers Radio, and Sunday nights is a show, Symposium of Sound. In our early stages, we were focusing more on Marcus Foster, Sam Bradley, and Bobby Long songs. We pick one song from each guy for all three of us to decipher their lyrics, analyze it, see what we liked about it, what kind of imagery we got, and we play the music too. From there on, we're getting some new artists that we get to play on our Music Mondays, and we're going to start playing them as well, and really trying to put some unsigned artists out there for everybody to enjoy. Correct, Tara?
That is correct. We have an Irishman by the name of Chris Keys. He'll be featured on one of our upcoming shows. He's really good. And we're in the works for a few others. We've had a few responses to our queries, so we'll try to create a show schedule and get that out to everyone fairly soon. But tonight, it should be a great show. We took some opinions out of the chat room last week and asked what they'd like to discuss tonight. So tonight we're going to be doing This Strange Love by Bobby Long, In Your Head by Marcus Foster, and It Begins by Sam Bradley.
And our listeners over here on Vamp Radio can find that at blogtalkradio.com/dreamersradio.
Yes, yes.
There we go. Okay, everyone, like I said last week, I think I said it Friday, we got some big, big news coming up. So come to our shows to hear the big news. That's all I got to say. Big news. Big,
you know,
big.
He's at all.
Huge news.
And Courtney's part of the news.
Life-altering.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, it is life-altering news. Okay, I got to go because I got to go watch Three Rivers, even though it's getting canceled. I still want to watch it.
You have fun. I'm going to go
eat. Yeah, I'm going to go prep for Symposium of Sound, so I hope I see everyone there later this evening.
Absolutely.
Yes, if I'm not passed out, I will be there.
Because we know your names. We know who you are, and we know when you're not there.
Exactly.
Bye,
okay,
now,
bye,
everybody.
All right.
Bye.
Have a good night, everyone. Bye.